Catalyzed by the popularity of the folk group the Kingston Trio, small music clubs began to sprout in every unlikely venue. Shopping malls and restaurant cellars now had corner stage showrooms that sometimes did and sometimes didn't serve alcohol. There were no clubs dedicated to comedy. They did not exist for at least 15 years, so every comedian was an outsider. The Paradox in Tustin was where I first saw the Dillards, a bluegrass group that played hard and made us laugh too, and featured the whiz-bang five-string banjo picker Doug Dillard, who looked like a grin on a stick but played with staggering speed and clarity. There was the Rouge et Noir in Seal Beach, where I saw David Troy, a.k.a. David Somerville, a.k.a. Diamond Dave, a singer-guitarist who had the ladies swooning and who had been, years earlier, the lead singer on the Diamonds' monster hit Little Darlin'. I didn't realize I was hearing one of the most famous voices in early rock and roll. At the Mecca in Buena Park, I saw the up-and-coming comedian Pat Paulson, who opened with this funny line, "I've had a great life, with the exception of 1959, when, unfortunately, I passed away." The best opening line ever heard was from Sam Kinison. In the late 80s, playing the Comedy Store in Los Angeles, he said, "You're going to see a lot of comedians tonight. Some will be good, some will be okay, but there's a difference between me and them. Them, you might want to see again sometime." But wait, maybe the best opening line I heard was Richard Pryor's, after he started 2 hours late in front of a potentially miffed crowd at the Troubadour in Los Angeles. He said simply, "Hope I'm funny." Using the Birdcage as a home base, I flirted with outside work, auditioning for gigs while keeping my class load at school as light as possible. The Prison of Socrates was the music club in the T-shirts and shorts town of Balboa. The prison's main star was a charismatic sandal-clad folk singer named Tim Morgan, who was so popular that for several months in Southern California, his record outsold the Beatles' A Hard Day's Night. My Monday night audition at the prison was marginal, but because the opening acts were usually marginal anyway, I was hired for a weekend tryout. I now had my first job outside Knott's Berry Farm, which presented a particular difficulty. It was one thing to do 5 minutes at the Birdcage, or 10 minutes at a hoot, but it was another thing to do 20 minutes for paying customers. Furiously trying to expand the act before my 3-day gig, I threw in earnest readings of the poets E. E. Cummings, T.S. Eliot, Carl Sandburg, and Stephen Vincent Benet, all aimed at stretching my act to show length. Nobody cared about hearing Eliot and Cummings in a nightclub, but the Benet piece, a Sacco narrative poem about a fiddle contest in Georgia, stayed in the act for at least a year until I canned it. Opening night, I stood in the parking lot behind the club, going over my material and warming up on the banjo. Adjacent to garbage cans and blowing with beach sand, the parking lot was where the opening acts tuned up and rehearsed, as there was no place else to practice out of the audience's earshot. I performed to a sparse crowd, among them my college friend Phil Carey, his brothers, and their dates. How did it go? I have no idea. My only memories of it are the unsettling echoes of chairs screeching on the concrete floor as patrons adjusted their seats. After the show, I was informed by my college friends that I had mispronounced the word incomparable. I now had 2 credits, the Birdcage and the Prison of Socrates. My Disneyland credit was not quite professional, and I was able to land intermittent jobs, among them the Ice House in Pasadena, which had been converted from, guess what, an ice house. Many earnest folk musicians appeared there, strumming guitars and wearing shirts with puffy sleeves. At the Ice House, I faced a real nightclub audience and performed almost as frequently as I did at the Birdcage. 3 shows a night was standard at these small clubs. Eventually, I ingratiated myself with enough venues that I wondered if I could possibly finance my life without the security of my steady job at Knott's Berry Farm. Having no agent or any hopes of finding one, I could not audition for movies or television or even learn where auditions were held. I didn't know about trade papers, Variety or The Hollywood Reporter, from which I might have gathered some information. I lived in suburbia at a time when a 1-hour drive to Los Angeles in my first great car, a white 1957 Chevy Bel Air, which, despite its beauty, guzzled quarts of oil and spewed it back into the air in the form of white smoke, seemed like a trip across the continent in a Conestoga wagon. But the local folk clubs thrived on single acts, and as usual, their Monday nights were reserved for budding talent. Stand-up comedy felt like an open door. It was possible to assemble a few minutes of material and be on stage that week, as opposed to standing in line in some mysterious world in Hollywood, getting no response, no phone calls returned, and no opportunity to perform. On Mondays, I could tour around Orange County, visit 3 clubs in one night, and be on stage, live, in front of an audience. If I flopped at the Paradox in Tustin, I might succeed an hour later at the Rouge et Noir. I found myself confining the magic to its own segment so I wouldn't be called a magician, even though the idea of doing comedy had sounded risky when I compared it to the safety of doing trick after trick. I wanted, needed, to be called a comedian. I discovered it was not magic I was interested in, but performing in general. Why? Was I in competition with my father? No, because I wasn't aware of his interest in show business until years later. Was my ego out of control and looking for glory? I don't think so. I am fundamentally shy and still feel slightly embarrassed at disproportionate attention. My answer to the question is simple. Who wouldn't want to be in show business? I looked around the birdcage and saw actors who had worked there 15 years and counting, and I knew it could be a trap for me. With some trepidation, I gave notice. Stormy was gone, Kathy was gone, John Stewart and Paul Shackleton were gone too, so there were no actual tearful goodbyes. Handshakes with George and Woody. At age 21, 3 years after I had started at the birdcage, I slipped away almost unnoticed. I continued to attend Long Beach State College, taking Stormy-inspired courses in metaphysics, ethics, and logic. New and exhilarating words such as epistemology, ontology, pragmatism, and existentialism, words whose definitions alone were stimulating, swirled through my head and reconfigured my thinking. One semester I was taking philosophy of language, continental rationalism, whatever that is, what, Descartes, history of ethics, and to complete the group, self-defense, which I found especially humiliating when, one afternoon in class, I was nearly beaten up by a girl wearing boxing gloves. A course in music appreciation focused me on classical music, causing me to miss the pop music of my own era, so I got into the Beatles several years late. I was fixated on studying, and even though I kept my outside jobs, my drive for learning led to a significant improvement from my dismal high school grade average. I was now an A student. I switched to cotton pants called peggers because I had vowed to grow up in abandoned jeans. My look was strictly wholesome Baptist. A friend lent me some comedy records. There were 3 by Nichols and May, several by Lenny Bruce, and 1 by Tom Lehrer, the great song parodist. Mike Nichols and Elaine May recorded without an audience, and I fixated on every nuance. Their comedy was sometimes created by only a subtle vocal shift. "Tell me, Dr. Schweitzer, what is this reverence for life?" Lenny Bruce, on the records I heard, was doing mostly non-political bits that were hilarious. Warden at a prison riot. "We're giving in to your demands, men! Accept the vibrators!" Tom Lehrer influenced me with one bizarre joke. "My brother Henry was a nonconformist. To show you what a nonconformist he was, he spelled his name H-E-N-3-R-Y. Some people fall asleep at night listening to music. I fell asleep to Lenny, Tom, and Mike and Elaine. These albums broke ground and led me to a Darwinian discovery. Comedy could evolve. On campus, I experienced 2 moments of illumination, both appropriately occurring in the bright sun. Now comfortable with indulging in overthinking, I was walking across the quad when a thought came to me, one that was nearly devastating. To implement the new concept called originality, that I had been first introduced to in Showmanship for Magicians, and was now presenting itself again in my classes in literature, poetry, and philosophy, I would have to write everything in the act myself. Any line or idea with even a vague feeling of familiarity or provenance had to be expunged. There could be nothing that made the audience feel they weren't seeing something utterly new. This unfortunate fact mortified me. I did not know how to write comedy at all. But I did know I would have to drop some of my best one-liners, all pilfered from gag books, and consequently lose 10 minutes from my already strained act. Even worse, I would have to lose another prime gag I lifted, Carl Ballantyne's never-fail Appearing Dove, which had been appropriated by almost every comic magician under the age of 20. Ballantyne would blow up a paper bag and announce that he was going to produce a dove. "Come out flying," he would say. Then he would pop the bag with his hands, and an anemic flutter of feathers would poof out from the sack. The thought of losing all this material was depressing because, After several years of working up my weak 20 minutes, I was now starting from almost zero. I came up with several schemes for developing material. I laugh in life, I thought, so why not observe what it was that made me laugh? And if I did spot something that was funny, I decided not to just describe it as happening to someone else, but to translate it into the first person, so it was happening to me. A guy didn't walk into a bar, I did. I didn't want it to appear that others were nuts. I wanted it to appear that I was nuts. Another method was to idly and abstractly dream up bits. Sitting in a science class, I stared at the periodic table of the elements that hung behind the professor. That weekend, I went on stage at the Ice House and announced, "And now I would like to do a dramatic reading of the periodic table of the elements." "Phi. Oh. He," I said. That bit didn't last long. In logic class, I opened my textbook, the last place I was expecting to find comic inspiration, and was startled to find that Lewis Carroll, the supremely witty author of Alice's Adventures in Wonderland, was also a logician. He wrote logic textbooks and included argument forms based on the syllogism, normally presented in logic books like this. All men are mortal. Socrates is a man. Therefore, Socrates is mortal. But Carroll's were more convoluted, and they struck me as funny in a new way. Babies are illogical. Nobody is despised who can manage a crocodile. Illogical persons are despised. Therefore, babies cannot manage crocodiles. And no interesting poems are unpopular among people of real taste. No modern poetry is free from affectation. All your poems are on the subject of soap bubbles. No affected poetry is popular among people of taste. Only a modern poem would be on the subject of soap bubbles. Therefore, all your poems are uninteresting. These word games bothered and intrigued me. Appearing to be silly nonsense, on examination, they were absolutely logical, yet they were still funny. The comedy doors opened wide, and Lewis Carroll's clever fancies from the 19th century expanded my definition of what comedy could be. I began closing my show by announcing, "I'm not going home tonight. I'm going to Banana Land, a place where only two things are true. Only two things. One, all chairs are green. And two, no chairs are green." Not at Lewis Carroll's level, but the line worked for my contemporaries, and I loved implying that the one thing I believed in was a contradiction. I also was enamored of the rhythmic poetry of E.E. Cummings, and a tantalizing quote from one of his recorded lectures stayed in my head. When asked why he became a poet, he said, "Like the burlesque comedian, I am abnormally fond of that precision which creates movement." The line, with its intriguing reference to comedy, was enigmatic, and it took me 10 years to work out its meaning. The second illuminating moment occurred when I was walking to class from a parking lot so far from campus that I could see the curvature of the earth. Again, under the bright California sun, I saw a girl with short black hair pertly walking in faded blue jeans. I was nervous about saying hello, but she offered me a welcoming smile that said it was okay. She had an unmelodic name, Nina Goldblatt, and she was a professional dancer. We started running into each other accidentally at every opportunity. I only had to get over the hurdle of her dating the handsome actor Vince Edwards, who played the TV doctor Ben Casey, and who was sending limos down to Long Beach to chauffeur her to Hollywood. Somehow I did, and a new romance was on. Nina was a dancer in the Mickey Finn Show, a banjo and pizza whoop-de-doo, with an upcoming appearance in Las Vegas on the Fabled Strip. I drove 5 hours to spend the weekend with her and was captivated by the city. But my excitement was dampened by having only $4 in my pocket. I was so broke that when I hit a nickel slot for 50 cents, it momentarily changed the quality of my life. It was Nina who had the dough, and we learned that Vegas could support even the poorly healed by offering $1.25 all-you-can-eat buffets. Nina treated me to some Vegas nightclubs, and I fantasized about starring as a lounge act at a spiffy hotel. We went to see the Jets, a two-man comedy music team whose gags included passing through the audience using the microphone as a falsy detector. I enjoyed my time with Nina. She was funny and saucy as well as cute, and 1 year later, she was to have a significant effect on my professional life. My college roommate, Phil Carey, was an artist and musician. He sang bass, not in a barbershop quartet, but for a sophisticated chorale that featured music with complicated rhythms and mismatched 12-tone arrangements. Phil's contagious enthusiasm got me excited about art, particularly the avant-garde, and we quickly noted that the campus art scene was also a great arena to meet girls. We loved reading magazine reports of New York galleries stuffed with Warhol's Brillo boxes and giant flowers, Lichtenstein's cartoon panels, and throngs of people dressed in black. One afternoon I donned Phil's beret, which meant I was disguised as an artist, and sneaked into his life drawing class, where an attractive nude blonde was casually displaying herself. I was all business on the outside, but on the inside I was shouting, "Yee-haw!" Phil had a developed sense of humor. His cat was named Miles, and when asked if the cat was named after Miles Davis, Phil would say, "No, it was, and miles to go before I sleep." Working on a college project, Phil landed an interview with the great American composer Aaron Copland. However, he would have to drive from Los Angeles to Peekskill, New York to conduct it. I jumped at the chance to go along. In the summer of 1966, I was still 20 and proud that I would make it to New York City before I turned 21. We installed a makeshift cot in the back of my coughing blue windowless VW bus, and we drove across America without stopping. I was trying to write like E.E. Cummings, so my correspondence to Nina, all highly romantic, goopy, and filled with references to flowers and stars, read like amateur versions of his poems. Nina saved the letters, but they are too embarrassing to reproduce here. 3 days after we left Los Angeles, Phil and I arrived at Aaron Copland's house, a low-slung A-frame with floor-to-ceiling windows set in a dappled forest by the road. We knocked on the door, Copland answered it, and over his shoulder we saw a group of men sitting in the living room wearing only skimpy black thongs. He escorted us to his flagstone patio, where I had the demanding job of turning the tape recorder on and off while Phil asked questions about Copland's musical process. We emerged a half hour later with the coveted interview and got in the car, never mentioning the men in skimpy black thongs because, like trigonometry, we just didn't quite comprehend it. We drove to West Reading, Connecticut, for a tour of the house of another great American composer, the late Charles Ives. Speaking with Ives' son-in-law, George Tyler, we learned the peculiar fact that Ives was an avant-garde composer by night and an insurance agent by day. After a detour to Cambridge, Massachusetts, to cruise the home of my idol Cummings, we drove into glorious Manhattan. Saucer-eyed, we hustled over to the Museum of Modern Art, where we saw, among the Cezans and Matisses, Dalí's famous painting of melting clocks, the shockingly tiny, the persistence of memory. We were dismayed to find that Warhol and Lichtenstein had not yet been ordained. We drove to 8th Avenue, and Phil circled the block while I retrieved from the imposing Central New York Post Office a lively and welcome letter from Nina, sent to me care of General Delivery, New York City. I bounded down the massive steps, waving the onion-skin envelope aloft for Phil to see, as though it were the lost map of the Incas. Before we left Cambridge, I sent this postcard to Nina. "Dear Nina, today, about an hour ago, I stood in front of E.E. Cummings' home at Harvard. His wife is still living there, we saw her. But the most fantastic thing was when we asked directions to Irving Street. The person we asked said to tell Mrs. Cummings hello from the Jameses. She turned out to be William James's great-granddaughter." Then I added, "I have decided my act is going to go avant-garde. It is the only way to do what I want." I'm not sure what I meant, but I wanted to use the lingo, and it was seductive to make these pronouncements. Through the years, I have learned there is no harm in charging oneself up with delusions between moments of valid inspiration.